The Audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. All right, what are we reading today? Because there's some really unfortunate legislation making its way on the floor that I really want to talk about on tomorrow's episode, I kind of want to lay the groundwork for the discussion on privacy and encryption with one that's actually an op-ed on Bitcoin Magazine, and it's titled A Bitcoin Fungibility, Mixing, and the Legal Limits on Maintaining Privacy. Because as anybody who's listened to the show for any amount of time knows that I think privacy is a huge concern and something that is critical to get back in this new ecosystem. And there are going to be a lot of challenges as we kind of make our way into this new space. So let's go ahead and jump into the article. It's written by Sasha Hodder and Raphael Jacoby. A quick thank you to Bitcoin Magazine for letting us read this article on the show and for sharing it out on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network. And, of course, to Swan Bitcoin, the best place to auto-buy that sweet, sweet Bitcoin sound money, for supporting the Audible of the Bitcoin space. That's what we got. Let's go ahead and jump into today's article, and then we'll get Guy's take afterward. On February 13, 2020, Larry Harmon of Akron, Ohio, was charged with three counts. 1. Conspiracy to commit money laundering. 2. Operating an unlicensed money transmitting business. And 3. Conducting money transmission without a DC license. According to the DOJ, Harmon operated Helix, which was also known as a Tumblr or Mixer, without registering as a money services business or money transmitter. These technologies allow a user to obfuscate the origin of their Bitcoin. Regulations on Bitcoin privacy. According to the Bank Secrecy Act, exchanging virtual currency, among other things, is a FinCEN-regulated activity. According to FinCEN, quote, an exchanger is a person engaged as a business in the exchange of virtual currency for real currency, funds, or other virtual currency, end quote. An exchanger must register with FinCEN as a money services business, or MSB. Once registered, the exchanger must implement procedures reasonably designed to prevent money laundering. Blockchain analysis and financial privacy. While the standard of reasonableness is evolving, one possible way to prevent money laundering is blockchain analysis. Blockchain analysis companies have large marketing budgets and are persuading crypto exchanges to use their services in order to de-risk the exchange's own compliance reporting duties. Similarly, though not required by law, some larger banks have made the use of blockchain forensic analysis services a condition of getting a bank account, akin to the Dragnet surveillance exposed by Edward Snowden in 2013, these services attempt with debatable accuracy to identify the history of a Bitcoin, which, absent other intervening actions, potentially exposes all past and future transactions made by the user who broadcasted the transaction. Blockchain forensic analysis can include the collection of large amounts of personal information about a user's spending habits, total holdings, and whether or not the Bitcoin has traveled to the dark web or been used for something illegal. Aside from privacy considerations related to the over-collection of data, the requirement that companies purchase these services can significantly raise the costs of entry into the industry, reducing competition and depriving consumers of the choices they might otherwise have when obtaining financial services. If a blockchain analysis service determines that particular Bitcoin have been involved in criminal activity, these Bitcoin are referred to as tainted. The concept of tainted Bitcoin is controversial. The ultimate objective for a blockchain analysis company, and thus the government to which they offer their services, is to know who owns the Bitcoin. It's a tall order, but if they can accomplish this, financial privacy on Layer 1 Bitcoin will be non-existent. Cleaning Bitcoin. One fail-safe way to remove a Bitcoin's alleged taint is to have it seized by the government and resold at an auction. Once it's passed through the government, regulated cryptocurrency exchanges can begin accepting it again. It is, quote, clean. The other way to, quote, clean a Bitcoin is to break the link between the Bitcoin's past and current transactions by running it through a Tumbler, Mixer, or CoinJoin. Tumblers and Mixers are custodial. This means that when one uses a Tumbler or Mixer, they must give control of their coins to another party and trust that this party will return the Bitcoin to them. By contrast, there are various implementations of CoinJoin that can be conducted without sacrificing control of your coins. Not your keys, not your Bitcoin. While most agree that the government has a legitimate interest in fighting crime, some privacy advocates are concerned that industry standards are being heavily influenced by two powerful forces that may not properly weigh financial privacy concerns. 1. The Global Financial Action Task Force, an intergovernmental agency that seeks to assist global governments in surveillance and tax collections. And 2. Compliance companies that stand to gain immensely from lucrative government contracts. From the privacy advocates' perspective, the more draconian measures that interested groups, whether public or private sector, can push for, the more money the compliance companies will make. In an ideal world for a forensic blockchain analysis company, a user's personal privacy may be considered evidence of criminal activity. Privacy and fungibility go hand in hand. Fungibility is defined as capable of being substituted in place of one another. Fungibility is a critical quality of money. Consider the following example. If Alice lends Bob a $10 bill, Alice does not need to be repaid with the very same $10 bill. Any $10 bill will do. In the same sense, Alice could accept one $5 bill and five $1 bills and still be satisfied, since the total equals $10. Conversely, as an example of non-fungibility, if Alice lends Bob her car, it is not acceptable for Bob to return a different car, even if it is the same make and model as Alice's original car. Cars are not fungible with respect to ownership. The gas that Bob buys to fill up the car upon its return, however, is fungible. As applied to Bitcoin, a looming concern is that if some Bitcoin are treated differently than others, then one of Bitcoin's inherent characteristics as money will be reduced, potentially hampering Bitcoin's future as a global reserve currency. Coin mixing and tumbling. Since the Bitcoin blockchain is publicly verifiable through the use of a block explorer, some users have taken to coin mixing or tumbling, where a user sends their Bitcoin to a service that accepts them and then sends the designated amount, minus fees, to the destination requested by the sender. This makes the origin nearly impossible for the recipient to decipher. There could well be nefarious reasons for individuals to want privacy in their transactions, but there are also legitimate reasons for using Bitcoin privately. For example, you might not want the people you transact with to be able to see how much money you have, or to be able to view all of your transactions and associations, past and future. CoinJoin. CoinJoin, first introduced by Greg Maxwell in 2013, is a privacy protection technique that does not require you to surrender custody to another party. CoinJoin is a process of combining multiple Bitcoin payments from multiple spenders into a single transaction to make it difficult for outside parties to determine which spender paid who. The distinction for CoinJoin is that CoinJoin is software, and FinCEN regulations exempt, quote, the delivery, communication, or network access services used by a money transmitter to support money transmission services, end quote. Custodial mixers. Section 4.5.1 of the May 2019 FinCEN guidance states that Providers of anonymizing services, such as custodial mixers, are money transmitters under FinCEN regulations. Anyone who provides anonymizing services by, quote, accepting value from a customer and transmitting the same or another type of value to the recipient in a way designed to mask the identity of the transmitter is a money transmitter under FinCEN regulations, end quote. Helix operated as a custodial mixer, where users' coins were allegedly sent to Harman's control and swapped, then different coins were sent back to the user or to a predetermined destination. This falls within the definition of money transmission. We have seen money laundering and money transmission charges go hand in hand in several other cases over the past few years. Not surprisingly, Harman, despite living in Ohio and engaging in a transaction with an undercover officer who was in D.C., is being tried in the mother of all courts, the Southern District of New York. This is the same court that sentenced Ross Ulbricht to double life plus 40 years. The SDNY also heard the Ripple case, the Tether Bitfinex Noble Bank case, the Shrim case, the Haney case, the M. Lars case, and the Vinnick case, to name a few. This is because the SDNY gets jurisdiction over cases involving terrorism, money laundering, international narcotics, and any other crime that the FBI, DEA, or ICE believe could threaten U.S. national security. FinCEN guidance versus the law. We've likely all seen the 2019 FinCEN guidance with its two-page disclaimer that it's just guidance. Well, the actual laws that Harman was charged with are as follows. 1. Federal money laundering. 2. Federal money transmission. And 3. District of Columbia money transmission. He was not charged with anything to do with AML D5, inspired by the Financial Action Task Force, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or international money laundering. But we will touch on those briefly as well, because he could have also been charged with any of them, too. Federal money laundering law. Federal money laundering is sending and receiving financial transactions, quote, involving the proceeds of specified unlawful activity with the intent to promote the unlawful activity. The allegations say the Bitcoin went through Alphabay and was used to buy illegal drugs. The Bitcoin to drug purchase happened on Alphabay. Then the drug dealer sent those Bitcoin to Helix. Harman knew these Bitcoin were the proceeds of illegal activity because he himself wrote about Alphabay being used for drugs. Then he mixed the Bitcoin and sent it to himself again at Dropbit, another layering transaction. And from there, a regular user could unknowingly get the tainted Bitcoin and risk future issues with traditional on and off ramps for the reasons outlined above. Money transmission, federal. The other federal charge complication is that most money laundering cases also involve unregistered money services business activity, meaning the company didn't register with FinCEN before setting up their dark web drug website. Consequently, this means they did not collect user data, report suspicious activity, or pay taxes. It seems plausible that this charge could stick. However, at first, this case looked interesting because it would be a case of first impression involving mixers. The mixer didn't actually play a part, though, because the transfers of Bitcoin from Alphabay to Helix, and then from Helix to the Dropbit wallet, are both transmissions, whether or not the coins were mixed on Helix at all. Money transmission in DC. The DC charge against Harman was unexpected. The DC money transmitter law has never been modified to include Bitcoin and never been tested against Bitcoin. The jurisdiction here comes because the undercover agent performed the transaction on trial from DC. As a result of this case, DC may have to refine their money transmission law. It would be nice if they would look to Montana, a state with no money transmission regulation, or Wyoming, which has adopted crypto-friendly money transmission rules. The Financial Action Task Force and AML D5. While Harman was not charged with anything related to the Financial Action Task Force guidance, nor could he be, since it is strictly guidance, The AML D5 has adopted much of this guidance into practice. The AML CTF European Union Directive 2018/843, AMGL5, was published in the Official Journal of the European Union and took effect on January 10, 2020. It covers providers that exchange services between fiat and cryptocurrencies, as well as custodial wallets. The task force's 59-page guidance, which is featured prominently on Google with a CipherTrace-sponsored advertisement, encourages all member countries to adopt the American rules. However, as a point of concern among privacy advocates, this guidance also introduces concepts of, quote, enhanced due diligence in reference to privacy-centric cryptocurrencies or software. Notably absent from the guidance are explicit privacy considerations for how to balance privacy with legitimate law enforcement objectives. The AML D5 directive suggests that it is essential to extend its scope, quote, so as to include providers engaged in exchange services between virtual currencies and fiat currencies, as well as custodian wallet providers, end quote. It also suggests that the EU monitor for, quote, suspicious activity by hiring, quote, entities to monitor the use of virtual currencies. Such monitoring, the directive states, quote, would provide a balanced and proportional approach, safeguarding technical advances and the high degree of transparency attained in the field of alternative finance and social entrepreneurship, end quote. Money Transmission Catch-All, OFAC. Harman was not charged with any OFAC violations, but he could have been. Had he processed a transaction for an individual, country, or Bitcoin wallet address that is on the sanctions list, he would have been in violation. But by not collecting the KYC data on his customers at Helix, Harman likely has no idea whether or not he serviced any sanctions list member. The OFAC, like FinCEN, is a component of the Department of the Treasury. It administers and enforces economic and trade sanctions. Are individual Bitcoiners responsible for knowing where our Bitcoin has been? No. Individuals are users, according to the 2013 FinCEN guidance. A user is a person that obtains virtual currency to purchase goods or services, or in Bitcoin's case, for speculation, as a savings vehicle, hedge, or store of value. Users are regulated by FinCEN. However, individuals are required to pay taxes on capital gains, and the information collected by FinCEN and most government agencies is under a memorandum of understanding that it can be shared with the IRS. The exception to this, which to our knowledge has not yet been tested in court, could be the laws regarding receiving stolen property. Generally, for someone to be guilty of receiving stolen property, they must know, or should have known, that the property they receive is stolen. For the overwhelming majority of users, this kind of knowledge is, for practical purposes, impossible. The exchanges, however, have all of the responsibility and liability to use reasonable steps to comply with their FinCEN obligations. Their banking partners are also likely to have higher compliance requirements of the exchange than are required by FinCEN, which can include using blockchain analysis tools. It's also possible that, at the bank's or compliance officer's discretion, the exchange must be advised not to accept coins that have come from a mixer or tumbler. Conclusion. The balance between law enforcement efforts and privacy is challenging. Nobody wants to see terrorism or violent crime, but individual rights are jeopardized when we continue, as a society, to freely and willingly give up a lot of our financial privacy. Maintaining Bitcoin's fungibility is arguably a necessity for Bitcoin to achieve one of its core value propositions, freedom. Bitcoin is the currency of the internet, and the internet is, or should be, free and global. Not all countries have the benefit of a strong and stable financial system or a trustworthy government. When privacy is eroded, so is freedom of speech and association. We lose our privacy every day as we agree to use custodial Bitcoin solutions. Privacy and data security are not suspicious. They are responsible actions that individuals should be encouraged to take to help protect our identities against hackers from America and abroad. As described above, exchanges must take reasonable steps to prevent money laundering. Whether that means accepting or blocking mixed coins is a decision that each exchange will make on their own. There is no codified standard. There is no law against CoinJoin. There is no definitive answer as to how far back they should check or whether they should check at all. Given the legitimate privacy concerns illustrated above, we encourage exchanges not to treat the use of CoinJoin in a Bitcoin's transaction history without any external evidence of wrongdoing as evidence of suspicious or criminal activity. We view CoinJoin as being no different than other standard privacy practices in Bitcoin, such as not reusing Bitcoin addresses. Quote, "For greater privacy, it's best to use Bitcoin addresses only once," end quote. Satoshi Nakamoto, November 25th, 2009. Bitcoin users should not be required to leak personal information in the same way they are encouraged not to accidentally disclose their social security number. Maintaining Bitcoin privacy helps prevent individuals from being victimized by hackers, terrorists, scammers and system hijackers, and authoritarian governments. It's hard to price when achieving Bitcoin privacy moves from an inconvenience to a legal, financial, or even safety-related necessity. Keeping the Bitcoin network private can be thought of as an act of unity by Bitcoiners in America to help keep the network useful for Bitcoiners in Venezuela and Hong Kong, indeed, around the world. United we stand, divided we fall. Thank you to the many sources who helped pull this knowledge together. Raphael and I have spent years learning the intricacies of money transmission and money laundering laws, and we have each helped many Bitcoin companies navigate these regulations. While everything written in this article reflects our own opinions, unless quoted directly, we appreciate the contributions to this topic provided by the following groups and individuals: the Samurai Wallet and Wasabi Wallet communities, Stefan Levera, 6102 Bitcoin, Ergo BTC, Peter Van Valkenburg, Matt Odell, and numerous other community contributors. This is an op-ed by Sasha Hotter and Raphael Jacoby. Views expressed are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Bitcoin Magazine or BTC Incorporated. All right, that will close out our article. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then I want to talk a bit about the implications of a lot of the stuff that's going on, and because there's a lot landing at the same time, really January, February, March, even though we've been kind of overshadowed with a whole lot of other stuff, there's quite a bit of privacy developments taking place, and so I want to dig into this topic. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and we'll jump back in. So there is a lot that is philosophically misaligned with how we go about the entire enforcement and regulatory system. I've talked a number of times previously on the show. It's been a while since I've covered anything around this topic, but around like kind of command and control regulation and the ideas of the bootleggers and Baptist, which is a brilliant theory that I think is such an important lens to look at all regulation through. Like the idea that who is the concept of the bootleggers and Baptist. You can like watch a couple of really good videos on YouTube by Bruce Yandel, the basically the originator of this concept, who's a professor in economics. And he talks about the general idea is that regulations will stick and be passed if the bootleggers and the Baptists are both aligned. If there's two separate parties, the party A, the bootleggers, are the ones that will profit massively from the regulation. They're the compliance officers. They're the lawyers in this situation. They're the Chainalysis companies, that sort of thing. And then the Baptists, the people who are terrorism is bad, national security. We need pure honest, moral people. That's the Baptist argument for why the bootleggers, this idea originated from the study of historical regulation and prohibition in particular, that the bootleggers were actually the ones who funded the Baptists' protest to get alcohol made illegal. Why? Because because prohibition pushes up the prices of those goods. The profit margins skyrocket for the largest and most violent prohibition, like cartels. So they needed prohibition, but they couldn't sell it on we need high prices and we need to make this illegal so that we can violently dominate the market. What they needed was a religious reason for the purity and goodness of humanity to outlaw alcohol, and then they could make all their money. So the Baptists are basically the marketing front, and the bootleggers are the profiteers. Looking through almost all of our regulation through this lens, and you can find them both, almost every single time, and it's why you get, rather than standards and qualitative regulation, what you end up with is command and control regulation. And I think Yandel actually says that it's something like 80 to 90% of all regulation is command and control regulation. Now, the difference between those two things is like a standards or like qualitative regulation would be just that you have to meet, you know, some sort of like a car crash test or something like that. Whereas the command and control regulation is that you need exactly this many of this exact sort of airbag in these locations and you need these crush zones. It's essentially telling them how to do their business rather than saying you need to keep the customer safe. You figure out how to do that. And in doing so, the command and control regulation, the standards regulations, don't have any opportunities for profit, because if the business can just choose anything anyway and come up with some incredibly clever and new efficient way to keep the customer safe, then who's going to profit? Nobody knows where the profit is going to come from, or the government contract, or what good or what specific product that everybody now has to buy to make their car safe. Instead, they make a command and control regulation. You have to put in an airbag, and the company that has the patent on airbags, and let's get this. Why not? Why one airbag? Why not airbags for everybody? Airbags for babies in the back seat. The more regulation, the more command and control regulation they can get, the more mountains of money they get from an industry that's propped up that would never be the size that it would be otherwise. And you immediately have a legal foundation for never having to worry about going out of business. Because if somebody does create a more efficient or better alternative to the airbag, doesn't matter, you still have to install airbags. And one of the really dangerous things that the philosophy, getting back to the idea of regulation, so just let's use that as a foundation for why all of these regulations are being put in place, why they're really getting the funding, why they're really getting the interest. There are bootleggers here. Blockchain analysis companies, compliance industry, lawyers, there's a lot of people who are going to benefit massively from having to deal with all of this crap. But what's most important is that the companies themselves are being made the enforcers. There's a quote right towards the beginning that once registered as a money transmitter, the exchanger must implement procedures reasonably designed to prevent money laundering. They're essentially outsourcing the job of the enforcement. They're making the actual institutions and services and products the police for the use of that product or service. Now, not to, I don't want immediately to jump into Godwin's law, but this is similar to how like the Nazis would use propaganda to make the citizens spy on each other and rat out each other. They would report, all the billboards and the signs and everything, report suspicious activity, make sure your neighbors and friends aren't harboring Jews and all of this stuff. It's essentially is when a state gets to the point that they're policing everything, that they're just, they micromanage and have to outlaw so many things. After we get 300,000 pages or so of regulation that is so onerous to actually enforce, that even the $4 trillion that our government sucks out of the economy every year isn't even close to enough to actually do the enforcement. It's an impossible cost to bear. They have grown their responsibility orders of magnitude past their competency, which was basically out the window the second they got started. So instead of actually enacting the control themselves, they're just going to threaten important choke points and let everyone else take the cost of doing the work. They're going to confiscate the money first and then force the company still to pay the cost of the enforcement. This is how you end up with incredibly strict directions for how the companies actually have to run their service. It's not about protecting the consumer or the user or the data itself. It is literally explicit. It's very command and control. Just like, you know, they're not requiring the car to be safe in certain situations or under certain conditions. They're requiring them to put in airbags, to put in explicit things in the car, or in this case, the product or service. And these things include relationships or essentially other services and other enforcement. It actually creates a distrust between the user and the service. It's actually put them at odds with each other. They are becoming opponents. You, the user, and the service that you are using become opponents. It's literally destroying the customer service relationship. And you see this so clearly in finance and banking that happens. It's how police treat people, and it's bleeding over into airlines, everything that becomes incredibly onerous, and like command and control regulation everywhere. Airlines, banking and financial services, you're treated to how police treat you. Why it becomes immediately a question of, you know, why do you want privacy? You know, why are you spending money here? How much do you make? Where did this money come from? Why are you using so much cash? They're taught to be suspicious of you rather than provide you a service. So actually serving the customer and taking drastic actions to protect the customer, like not taking the customer's sensitive information to begin with, even explicitly to protect them, is illegal. And in the age where a hack of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of users' personal data, social security numbers, and financial history coming in at practically once a month or every couple of months, it's ridiculous that somehow the solution to this is to have more middlemen and more third parties see and hold all of this data. Like, you're literally broadening the attack surface as fast and as hard as possible, and making the people who are at risk pay the cost of doing so. There's a quote that's right in line with this from the actual article. Aside from privacy considerations related to the over-collection of data, the requirement that companies purchase these services can significantly raise the costs of entry into the industry. Again, command and control. Think about this. They are requiring the purchase of a service that the market wouldn't normally buy. It is a subsidy of the worst kind. You're creating a huge market that would otherwise be a hundredth of its size. And, you know, that's why chain analysis companies, post bankers, I mean, go dig into the history of the New York, blockchain licensing. What was that bill? I can't remember, but it was literally a guy who used to be a senator or something, obviously a lawyer, but he implemented a ridiculous piece of regulation, of a compliance regulation called the Bit License. It's literally the reason that Swan Bitcoin is only available in 49 states. Like, when you go to these exchanges, like all over the place, you'll notice they'll say, when they say not available, it's almost universally not available in North Korea, not available in Russia, not available in New York. Those are the lists. That is an embarrassing list to be a part of. And that's what the New York State has done. That's the level of reasonable steps that these institutions are taking to essentially destroy our privacy and our safety. And the guy responsible for the BitLicense? Guess what he does now? He started a compliance company. That's right. The guy who created the ridiculous, impossible to comply with regulations started a compliance company to make sure people could comply with it, so they could pay him to find out how to comply with it. That's a special kind of corruption, isn't it? And again, it puts all of the cost on the industry itself. It forces all of the services and the exchanges to bear the cost of the enforcement, which is the one thing that those other institutions are actually supposed to do. So they're not even doing their own job that they're taking our money for, while at the same time creating an unsafe and unhealthy marketplace that is at odds with its own customers. And like mentioned in the quote, is it painfully limits the options available. Like, as soon as a good option comes up, the better it protects the consumer, the better it protects the user, and the less it spends on compliance or policing its own network of its own community, the more likely they are going to leave, the more likely that they are not going to be available, and that we are going to be stuck using the same conglomerates and corporate giants that we had to use before, because any small competitor just has hardly any option at all in competing. Essentially meaning those who care least about their customers are the most successful. Another really important externality of this is the fact that it actually promotes scammers. It promotes financial loss to the customer that does want privacy. Because if a customer, let's say a company actually tries to serve the customer, Helix Mixer being an example of actually giving privacy services, if they're actually granting privacy and they're not taking all of their customer information and not following legislation that they think is onerous or really just absurd, well, then by default, they have to be ready to exit scam to protect their own lives. This leads to the very problem the government is claiming to try to protect people from, that it forces companies, it forces those that are actually serving the customers to focus on the short term, constantly be worried that the government is going to come in and shut them down or haul them off and hit them with a list of, just like they said in this article, he only got accused of or charged with 3 crimes, but they went through like tons of other little things. It's like, he could have been charged with this. Surprised he wasn't. Could have been charged with this. It creates the conditions encouraging these people to be ready to exit with their customers' money and not plan for the long term, because long-term business might not even be possible. Who knows which regulatory agency or which set of enforcers is going to come after them next. And the bootleggers, another quote from the article that I saved here, from the privacy advocate's perspective, the more draconian measures that interested groups, whether public or private sector, can push for, the more money the compliance companies will make. In an ideal world for a forensic blockchain analysis company, a user's personal privacy may be considered evidence of criminal activity. Arguably, this is already the case. If you have any privacy in financial transactions, you are suspected of committing a crime almost immediately. The right to privacy in the Constitution is what we have today is a laughable parody of that supposed right that we have. And in doing so, companies that are not concerned with customer safety, that are literally seeking to be customers of the government, they don't seek to find customers in the market, and they want to control the market so that the governments are enforcing their businesses, their entire industry. Very similar to how Liberty Mutual, all these tax, like the tax software companies and the tax tax accountants and all that good stuff, that whole industry lobbies massively to prevent simplifying the tax code. Huge lobby effort from these guys. Why? Because none of them would be in business. If you just paid a flat 5% or you just paid a sales tax or something like that, if taxes were easy, the whole industry would vanish. $100 billion of wasted money would go back to the average person. They don't want that. If the bootleggers lose their bootlegging businesses, that's what all those tax simplifying and agents, all that stuff, all of it would be gone, because obviously you could do taxes so much simpler. Anybody who has ever looked at one of those forms, like the idea that from a user-friendly perspective, like if you handed that to like a UX designer, I don't know if they would just like bust out laughing or just cry. Like, it is the most absurd thing trying to go through. Like, I've done my taxes for a couple of years, and it is one of the most frustrating experiences to have. And so much of it is even like the wording is even like, what applies to this? And then to think that you're criminally obligated to know how to do it right. And like jumping from section 4AB.1 to get an explanation of what the hell this word in the middle of the sentence of section 10.14B is. It's so absurd. It's so absurd. It literally is designed to be absurd. Because if it's not, literally millions of people lose their jobs, because those jobs are based on making things slower, making things more expensive, destroying value. There are a lot of industries doing that today. The trillions and trillions of dollars that move through government, and the incredible mountain of regulations that go through the economy are literally all about, have the overwhelming consequence of slowing things down, making them more expensive, and putting us at greater risk. And it has a lot of other undesired consequences. There's that quote that I absolutely love. Simple, clear purpose and principles give rise to complex, intelligent behavior. Complex rules and regulations give rise to simple and stupid behavior. It's a great quote by D-Hawk, and I absolutely love that one. And it could not be a more pertinent picture to what we've got going on. And it goes hand in hand with the idea that all of these regulations are telling people how to do their business, not that they should or should not keep them safe. In fact, you know, as we've explained, just the opposite. Much of the regulations themselves are actually putting people at risk. Now, there's another quote here. The balance between law enforcement efforts and privacy is challenging. Nobody wants to see terrorism or violent crime, but individual rights are jeopardized when we continue as a society to freely and willingly give up a lot of our financial privacy. Now, the efforts to over-police in some vain attempt to stop terrorism and violent crime, this is one of the things, is that this will not stop or even lower violent crime or terrorism. I think the cost vastly outweighs the benefit. In fact, like, this is exactly those sorts of things that lead to terrorism, because it causes people to hate their own government. It causes this direct opposition between the institutions that should be serving people and the people themselves. fostering hate, dependency, and resentment is exactly how you create those sorts of things. It's exactly how you create violent crime, just like the drug war. You know, did you know that drugs weren't really violent before the drug war? It's because they were made illegal. Same with prohibition. Isn't it funny that we don't have cartels shooting people in the alcohol industry anymore? Why not? Because we don't have prohibition, but we do with all the other drugs. And thus we have gangs, we have cartels. It's an incredibly and potently violent system because there's no way to have a legitimate, safe business. You get immediately destroyed by the violent government coming in with their guns. They are creating violence in the market, not solving it. But it leads to a quote from John Adams that we covered in a couple episodes ago that I had not really heard this one specifically. I've always adhered to this concept, but it was a beautiful John Adams quote that really just hits the point perfectly. So I'm going to repeat it here. Quote, "It is more important that innocence be protected than it is that guilt be punished. For guilt and crimes are so frequent in this world that they cannot all be punished. But if innocence itself is brought to the bar and condemned perhaps to die, then the citizen will say, whether I do good or whether I do evil is immaterial, for innocence itself is no protection. And if such an idea as that were to take hold in the mind of the citizen, that would be the end of security whatsoever." To suggest that the solution to terrorism or violent crime or whatever it is to destroy everyone's privacy is to miss the point entirely. It's to make the innocent and the average citizen an enemy of the state. And as soon as you start walking down that road, as soon as you start taking that path, that perspective that, put the cost on the innocent, we'll put the cost on the market, we'll make all of our concerns about this tiny, almost insignificant cohort of the market, we'll put an enormous cost on everyone else just to help us find this, not prevent it, not be a solution to it whatsoever. In the same way that the drug war has been no solution whatsoever to the problem of drug addiction. It would be hilarious for anyone to argue such a thing. I'm sure there are people who do, but holy crap, what idiotic argument that would be. You can't even keep drugs out of prisons. There are people addicted to heroin in prison. Think about how absurd it is to think that it's worth the cost of trying to implement that at the size of a nation. But as soon as that's our philosophy, that we're not concerned about the innocent, we're not actually concerned about maintaining privacy, that is actually the barrier to us somehow stopping all terrorism, as if such a thing is even possible. As soon as you start walking down that path, then everything is in the way. Every right of every human being is in the way of stopping those things. The use of shoes. Parker Lewis goes into... hits it unbelievably well in the Bitcoin is not for criminals article. What normal everyday technology do criminals not use? That shirts help criminals, shoes help criminals, the internet helps criminals, Bitcoin helps criminals, the dollar helps criminals. Money laundering is $4. The dollar is the currency of money laundering and crime. How many things get outlawed? What are the externalities here? How many innocent people do we destroy to catch a handful of assholes that are going to be there one way or the other? And how many totalitarian governments do we create along the way? How many abuses by those in power? How many of those criminals, those hackers, those identity thieves end up in the very institutions that were designed to protect us, running the very regulations? Another quote a little bit later in the article. Bitcoin is the currency of the internet, and the internet is or should be free and global. Not all countries have the benefit of a strong and stable financial system or a trustworthy government, end quote. I'd argue that No countries have the benefit of a strong and stable financial system. What? Look at the last 2 weeks. Where is that? Where is the trustworthy government? Anywhere. Not all countries is an exaggeration. Where are the angels that are going to be in charge of all this stuff? Where are the perfect middlemen that won't get hacked? It's all a self-aggrandizing fairy tale that makes them the heroes when they are the weakness. They are the very vulnerability that they claim to be the solution of. We're going to protect from hackers and identity thieves, both of which could just as easily be a government employee or a government agent, and more often than not are. Like, look at the... Did anybody hear about the Crypto AG? They made encryption devices for governments all around the world. More than 120 governments, apparently. And that they've been selling this encryption equipment for 50-odd years. The CIA owned it. And it put backdoors in all of it. The NSA, we know from Snowden, the NSA is responsible for the largest global surveillance system ever. And for decades, this was hinted at by people who were called crazy. And not only were they all proven right, almost all of the predictions were not as bad as what they were actually doing. The hackers we should be concerned about are governments. They are by and far the majority of all hacking, all spying, all backdoors, all everything across the world. Those institutions specifically benefit from it. They are the institutions of lies and coercion. The idea that all of this is for national security, when it all implements dependency and weakness. It's actually an engineered weakness in our security. Like the National Security Agency, the NSA, that's supposed to be protecting our communications and everything from, you know, foreign invaders and terrorists and all other governments and et cetera, is specifically the one that has weakened our entire infrastructure. They have put backdoors and surveillance built in to our entire communications infrastructure. How does that make us safer from these people? How does that make us less susceptible to, like, putting a backdoor in Bitcoin? Does that make us less susceptible to some other country, to a hacker? I don't know. Obviously, this is a contentious issue for me. The fact that this has gotten worse, and I'm also worked up about the Earn It bill that we'll be talking about probably tomorrow, or at least that I want to get into this week. But it's just so crazy. Hats off to all the guys that are helping to keep privacy alive, for just the fact that Bitcoin exists, that we wouldn't even have any alternative here. And I love, too, that I think Lightning Network is going to be a huge privacy boost. I think that's going to be a very undervalued part of the protocol, that it implements privacy and onion routing by default, and that blockchain analysis already is debatably questionable. It does not produce very good results. The Chainalysis, the blockchain analysis companies definitely benefit from the perception that it's better than it is, and it really isn't great. There's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of unreliable data and connections. But that becomes even more difficult because you have to switch it to network analysis when you're talking about Lightning Network and transactions there. So I think we're going to continue to get incremental privacy, and these sorts of things, and the amazing cost and fallout from the constant overstepping of their bounds and essentially the outlaw of privacy. I really feel like privacy is just against the law. It is not that explicit, but largely that's the case. That's just the case most of the time. You're treated like a criminal. It's perceived as evidence that you have done some sort of criminal activity, and it alone is a reason to go after somebody or to target somebody rather than any connection to a crime. What they would do then is they would go looking for the crime because you wanted your privacy. And that, on top of 100 other things, is a horrific precedent to set, but it's been set many, many times now. And it's business as usual. And is getting worse, thanks to a lot of this craziness that has happened and the opportunity to push a whole lot of stuff through, it looks like, while everybody's busy talking about coronavirus. So if you guys want to get a head start on the next discussion we want to get into, check out Earn It. Please pay attention to it. We are going to lose it. They've managed to create an anti-encryption bill. It does not have the word encryption in the bill. They've found a very clever way to force the market to end encrypted communications. So it is absolutely our obligation, our responsibility. And the end of this, God, I love the conclusion to this article. Hats off to Sasha and Raphael for this. Was that... I'll just read the whole last paragraph because it's just good. It's hard to price when achieving Bitcoin privacy moves from an inconvenience to a legal, financial, or even safety-related necessity. Keeping the Bitcoin network private can be thought of as an act of unity by Bitcoiners in America to help keep the network useful for Bitcoiners in Venezuela and Hong Kong, indeed around the world. United we stand. Divided we fall. And that is something that we must not forget. Yes, we can. It's so easy to give up a little bit of privacy for convenience. It's so easy to be like, oh, we'll let them do this one little thing and then forget about it after a couple of weeks. And then they'll do the next little thing. But if nobody in America has privacy, well, then it makes it that much easier. Remember, this is an anonymity set. Anybody who's listened to anything we've talked about in privacy and anonymity, your anonymity set is crucial. And if the only people who have any amount of quote-unquote privacy are the people in Venezuela and Hong Kong, and everybody in America is identified and easily traced, well, then nobody in Hong Kong and Venezuela has privacy. The anonymity set falls to nothing, and you're putting them at risk. If we don't stand up and explain our position and that privacy is not a crime, you don't have a door on your bathroom because you do heroin every time you shut it. Like, you're in there taking a shit and that's nobody else's business. So privacy is a huge point for me, and we've talked about it many, many times on the show, and I think it's deeply connected to 99 out of 100 reasons why Bitcoin is absolutely necessary. And I didn't even get to fungibility, but I've already gone on forever with this one. So we'll let that go for next time. Thank you guys for listening. A huge thank you to Bitcoin Magazine, Sasha and Raphael for this amazing article. I'll have a lot of links to all this. They clearly know their stuff. The amount of details in here is amazing. So hats off to all the work that I'm sure went into this. Don't forget to follow me, subscribe to The Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Thank you and much love to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for sharing this out with their audience. And to Swan Bitcoin, the best place to auto buy and stack your sats. They will be releasing in just a couple of days now. It is like right around the corner. I'm so excited. I've been wanting a service like this for ages to just set it and forget it. Like, just buy Bitcoin every single day, every single week, every paycheck, whatever it is. And Swan Bitcoin is where it's at. So thank you guys for listening. I love you all. I will catch you next time on The Crypto Economy. Back here tomorrow with another episode. Until then, take it easy, guys.